Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I had Jay Gujral. Jay is a repeat founder, angel investor and blockchain native operator who spent the last decade at the intersection of emerging tech, data integrity and startup ecosystems. This is the second part of a two-parter. If you haven't checked out part one, do go back and have a look. In today's episode, we talk about Jay's entrepreneurial background, the state of the market, the UK and much, much more. Let's get straight into it. Hey guys. Guys, whilst I've got you for a second, I thought I'd just reintroduce myself. My name's Arish. I'm the host of Nothing Ventured, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture ecosystem go round. I'm also the founder of Emerge One, a consultancy that provides fractional CFO support to venture-backed tech startups from seed to Series B and beyond. If you enjoy the podcast, we would really appreciate it if you could rate, subscribe, and like wherever you listen, whether that's YouTube, Apple, or Spotify. And if you have anything you want to say to me, or even a guest that you'd like to recommend, do reach out on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'm always up for a bit of a natter. Right, let's get straight into it. Can I ask you this question? So this intrigues me at a cultural level. Mm. Was your family entrepreneurial?
Yeah, my dad is.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Well, both my parents are actually. So they both had...
If you tell me you had a cash and carry, I'm going to slap you.
No, it wasn't a cash and carry. It was an art shop called Athena back in the day.
An art shop?
Yeah, yeah. As in like, they like... that was in the beginning. It was all Athena.
The
like,
posters?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Athena posters. So he had
is
a load
that
of them
business?
Across London. Yeah, yeah. So he had a load Jesus. Of them across London. And then he worked in recruitment for a bit. And then... started his own recruitment company and did very, very well, was doing, you know, millions in revenue a year. And then financial crash happened and restructuring and all that sort of stuff happened. But yeah, he's happy doing as now a one man band, just doing a few deals a year and he's happy doing his own thing. But yeah, my dad's always been entrepreneurial in that sense. And then, yeah, my mum was helping him alongside all of those ventures along the way as well.
And how much do you think that played into? Because again, like, you know, the this whole narrative that's been out there with Gary's economics and whatever, all that crap, like, you know, your yeah. heredity is your provenance defines where you're going to go, right? Like if you don't have a rich dad, if you don't have whatever. But I don't agree with anything that he says, clearly. Mm. Let's just get that on the record. But I do think it helps when you, I think it helps having... come from an entrepreneurial family.
No, it helped.
To understand
it helped a lot
the rest of what you're going to do.
My dad was in a really comfortable job. Like he was the best like recruiter at the company he was at, earning huge amounts of money, and then decided to leave and start up his own thing and then take all the clients with him because they were buying into him. And I was like, but it wasn't just that. Like I only learned that bit later on in life. Mm. But when I was younger, it was a case of I'm being... exposed to like Tony Robbins and, you know, all these sorts of like self-help business, like things are in the back of my mind constantly. You're just hearing it in the car, whatever. And then, it would just resonate. Like I remember, I think I was like 5 years old when I'd get, you know, one of those gold felt tip markers, like I'd take rocks from like the garden, paint them and sell them at school for 50p, for example.
Who's buying gold rocks?
At school, I'd realized what Alibaba was early in the day. Yeah. It wasn't Alibaba, it was DHgate back in the day, like when I was like 14, 15, like the first Chinese site that I saw. And I was like buying USB sticks from there, like gaudy gold watches, selling them at school for like 50, 60 quid. And it was ridiculous, but like that's what I started doing. And it was just the first of like, I'm actually really enjoying like business like this, if you know what I mean. And that's what was really interesting.
It's a hustle. So my corollary to that, highly illegal, but I was selling mixtapes at school.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, I've done the mixtape thing. Yeah, I've done the mixtape.
And then I just remember one day, like I literally had a briefcase full of these mixtapes. And I just remember like the head of middle school or the head of whatever he was, the head of whatever, I think it was the deputy headmaster.
Yeah.
And he just came, Mr. Shah, you're going to have to stop doing this. I said, what do you mean? And I had no idea it was illegal.
No, you just do it.
I didn't know copyright laws.
Exactly.
What are you talking about? I was just like, I was
just recording
providing
stuff
a service.
Home. Yeah, exactly.
Would you banter? People wanted it. Like,
no, I did the same because then I'd then do the same thing where I'd realize that I could burn DVDs.
Yeah.
I bought a burner. Yeah. I'd burn DVDs.
Rip,
I'd
burn
LimeWire. Rip it, sell it at school. And I was like, you know, this is great, but that's, you know, that's just what I loved it. And would I have done that if my dad wasn't how he was? Probably not. Yeah. Like, it's in, I'm not saying my dad's a wheeler dealer like that, but yeah. I was like way more intrigued by what business was at such an early age that I started to learn and teach myself all these sorts of like techie things.
I mean, I do think there's also a massive, I mean, like, you know, not to get into this detail necessarily, but like presumably your parents or their parents were migrants to the UK. I think there's a migrant mentality that comes with this stuff. I think there's also like, just frankly, like a subcontinent Indian mentality, like, you know, so I'm Gujarati, and like, you know, Thatcher described the UK as kind of a nation of shopkeepers. Mm. I mean, Gujaratis describe themselves as dukavadas, like a lot, you know, like they run shops, what's interesting, I think, you know, I had a conversation with a friend of mine who has like has a couple of businesses in the lighting space, right? Like they sell lighting and fittings and accessories. Nice. And he goes, the big problem, because his dad's still in the business, the big problem is the dukawala mentality. I go, what do you mean? He goes, we can't grow because we want to control, right? Like if I'm not in the shop and not in the warehouse and not in the whatever, or his dad in this instance, like there's too much fear of...
It's true. You know, like where my parents live in Essex, like in Barkingside, there's this bunch of... there's Indian grocer called Veena's, right? I've known it for years. That's where we go and get all our, you know, Indian stuff from that we need, spices, whatever.
No, but there's a couple of good ones around the corner, I can tell you.
Yeah, but like 10 years it'd been there, if not slightly longer. But now they've taken over the shop next door, then the shop next door, then the shop next door. And this whole row of shops has now turned into this basically almost like a superstore.
Yeah.
But you see the same faces there all the time because they don't want to not have, like you said, the control of it. But they're now growing it into this empire. And it's actually incredible to see because they're so hardworking. God knows what time they start. God knows what time they finish. 7 days a week, they're there. And they just love what they do. Like you can tell it's like family run as well. And it's incredible.
Right. Well, look, I want to move on to some other stuff. That was a bit of a diversion. look, you and I have, I mean, like, you know, we have a couple of WhatsApp chats that we're on, and you know, there's a lot of banter that happens. I mean, a lot of it is obviously kind of Chatham Housey banter, but let's have a quick chat about where you see the wider kind of state of the market venture. The UK, like there's a lot of negativity and like weirdly negativity and positivity. So you have Project Europe, you know, and I know Alex McDonald really well, who's obviously, you know, one of the LPs, but, you know, quite vocal about what they're doing, as is obviously Harry Stebbings and the team that he's built around that. But then you equally have this kind of very doom and gloomy kind of atmosphere in the UK where it's like, well, it just feels like everything's a bit, well, going in the wrong direction might be too strong, but it certainly feels like things are slipping in some ways. And then obviously you've got what's happening in global markets in the US and you know, both the trade war and the actual wars, etc. So yeah, I mean, like from where you're sitting, and you were heavily involved with Block Dojo, you're now doing Record, you've been in the kind of VC environment for quite some time. Yeah, what are your thoughts? Where are we? Where do you think we're heading?
Honestly, I find it really difficult to answer that because it just seems to change so quickly, like every day. I think in my brutal view, I think that anyone trying to be an emerging fund manager right now is going to really struggle.
Yeah.
To be honest.
I agree.
I think that money is going in places it knows it can actually make a return now rather than go down a more risky route.
Yeah.
I think you're seeing a lot more like CVCs pop up. Mm. So businesses.
Corporate venture capital.
So you're seeing businesses start their own venture capital arms to the business because they can trust where that's, you know, what they're investing in and where it's going to go. And I think I do see it going down a more corporate route now. And then like and just going back to the established brands, the ones that have been here for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, maybe 10 years plus, money going back into them, because where would you rather put your money right now? Are you going to risk it and get, I don't even know what the average return has been in UK funds recently, but
it's not, probably 4, 5, 6% max.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, in terms of like UK venture capital.
VC funds.
In terms of the UK VC funds, in terms of the emerging ones or the ones that have emerged.
The average is 1.8.
That's what I mean.
Whatever it's worth.
So it's not, that exciting?
Well, I think there's a couple of problems with emerging funds, right? I think a lot of emerging funds, emerging managers came out sort of in the 2020s, 2021.
Yeah, when there's lots of money.
A lot of money floating around, right? Able to take a punt. Now, if I was an LP going into those funds, exactly to your point, right? Going into those funds 2020, 2021, not seeing DPI, still too early probably to see DPI. I've got less risky returns here. Am I gonna invest in fund two? Possibly not. And it's not even just emerging managers. I know established managers that are struggling. Not struggling, right? Struggling is probably the wrong word, but it's taking longer to raise their fund three or four or whatever it is than one would have expected, given the pedigree and given the performance in the past. The thing that worries me actually with the emerging manager narrative is, you know, we had a lot of emerging managers coming up, certainly in the UK over the last several years, that were very focused on underrepresented groups, right? Whether that was funds focused on female founders or entrepreneurs, or whether that's funds that were focused on ethnic diversity or minority ethnic kind of founders, or whether it's, you know, specific sectors or whatever, right? And the concern I have, right, because I think that was a great step forward, and these are small funds, we're not talking about, like, we're talking 5 10 15 20 million, right? The concern I have is, if those funds disappear, there's no incentive for existing funds to necessarily capture what they were specifically trying to capture.
Yeah, and it's difficult when you've got Trump coming out with, you know, anti-DEI stuff, and you've got businesses, I think even Google removed DEI departments, right? Because they're not actually seeing the value it's bringing. It's, you know, it's just a pot of money that's going into departments, and it's not really providing the value that they see it should be providing. So when you've got that on top of then trying to fund, you know, what you're trying, this is where I think that, and we were talking about this earlier, where Bay HQ, which is something that we both know, British Asian Entrepreneur HQ, where
shout out to Amadeep, also been on the podcast.
Amadeep. Yeah. And then you've got like Founder Vine with a big focus on, you know, black founders, for example. Like, I think networks like that,
community-led,
the community-led stuff, I think is where it's going to be far more powerful than.
I also think that's where funds will go, like community managed funds or like community powered funds, if I can put it that way.
But this is what, and then taking it back to a Web3 thing, that's what,
of course you are,
because but that's what a DAO is, So that's what
decentralized autonomous organization. For
sorry,
those that don't know,
I should actually start defining what I'm saying. No, I hate,
yeah, but the fact that I know,
I do like that. I mean, but that's a really, really useful thing about what a Web3 thing, like where you've got a decentralized voting system for where money should go in a fund, for a group of people, or decision making should go. So I think that this is exactly what you're saying. I think that that's what's going to happen. It is going to be community led. It is going to be money going to, and that's what Foundervine are seeing. They're now growing in the US. Bay HQ is growing by setting up its own fund and wanting to invest in founders. I think that's the best way of understanding that ecosystem as well.
So my thoughts for what they're worth, which is often not a lot, but you know, that's fine. But my thoughts are, I think we're entering into a very, very large reset of the venture ecosystem.
Same.
I think first off the bat, I'm seeing anecdotally through my business that the majority of deals that we're seeing are in very R&D intensive businesses, right? So, you know, we're talking about life sciences, med tech, space tech, deep tech, material sciences, hardware, that sort of stuff. And all of which has a software layer, right? But it is very, very R&D intensive. So we're talking, you know, years to commercialization, right? These are not businesses. It's not a B2B SaaS where you can like build some tech and basically go out and, you know, hopefully ship it.
No, but there's an actual asset in the back end.
There is an actual asset, but the asset might not be worth anything because if the R&D is not like conclusively proven to work, then it doesn't work, right? But the problem that, so what you then have is what was a 7-year potential life cycle for a business for a VC to invest and harvest that investment.
It's 15.
It's now 13, 15, 20 years, right? And on top of that, A, certainly, you know, that lends itself to specialists rather than generalist VCs. So I think generalist VCs are going to start struggling a bit more maybe. But I think the other problem then, but the actual outcome for this, what I hope to see is that venture reverts back to kind of its roots, right? So if you think about venture in Silicon Valley, why is it there? It came out of like, you know, semiconductor research, the Trader Estate, et cetera, et cetera. Like it was investing in hard to solve capital intensive
problems.
But
this is what we were discussing earlier about Block Dojo, the founders and where we think founders are going to succeed is, you know, founders with deep sector experience starting businesses in those areas. Same with emerging fund managers now. You can't just be a generalist emerging fund manager and think that you can raise a load of capital.
Yeah.
Because it's really, really
so I'm
difficult.
Screwed. That's what you're basically telling me, right?
Like, it's, you know, maths and, you know, Excel and stuff. So yeah, there's probably something there. But you know what I mean? It's I think that if you've got sector expertise and you've got that edge on someone who doesn't have that, then of course you're going to, you know, of course you're going to win.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this reset is happening. I think there's some positive. I think the other thing that I think is super interesting is Europe in a world where the US is not necessarily as friendly as it used to be. That can change overnight, as we've seen, exactly. Right? So like between this podcast being recorded and the time it comes out, that might have pivoted 30 times. Yeah. We don't know. But what it seems to have done is galvanize Europe to figure out that shit, we need to actually think about like looking after ourselves a little bit. And what I hope to see, because the one thing that Europe and the UK does have is talent, right? Like, and it has incredible research, knowledge, universities. Like, you know, we actually are very good at that sort of stuff. I mean, I've had this conversation with a lot of Italian VCs because my wife's Italian, I speak Italian. It's like easy to have these conversations. And one of the things, because I always sit there and I'm like, it's so depressing. Like when I go to Italy, no one understands this stuff because no one's talking about venture or tech because it doesn't exist as really an asset class out there, which is bizarre because like I always say, Italy invented private equity. Why have they struggled with venture, right? But anyway, the point is Italy actually has some of the smartest research grads in Europe, right? Because their programs, like even to get an undergrad, you've got to sit through like 10 years in Italy. It's like bizarre, but anyway. But what happens, because there is no ecosystem, they go to the US, maybe come to the UK, possibly, but like the US is where you go, right? Because that's where things happen. So given that strength of talent and the pool that we have, you know, if we can get the capital to start matching that, right? And you know, I've had this conversation with a ton of people. We're really great pre-seed, seed, Series A. Thereafter, like, what the hell? And this is why, you know, everyone goes to the US, et cetera.
Well, like what Fixer did. They did the same thing. They moved straight to Silicon Valley, didn't they? But that was because they're now in, well, I can't remember who gave the anecdote about it, but it's now they're in this building with all sorts of other like aspiring founders and they're all working together.
It's the FT article, right?
Oh, that was it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That again, Alex McDonald.
Yeah, that was it. It was from Alex McDonald.
Yeah, so, you know, he he's done the same, right? Topco in the US to get the capital. Operating co in the UK because that's where like the team is and it's more efficient and it's more cost effective actually to have a team here, right? But equally, like we see it, like obviously as CFOs, we see all the time Topco flips, we see companies move. And in fact, like a lot of funds that we know, principally, if you don't go to the US, the fund is not going to invest in you because they just know that's where the opportunity and outcome is. That's where the capital is. That's where the market is.
Yeah.
And it's still crazy. US is a market of 300 million. Europe is 500 million. Yes, it's slightly more fragmented. You've got language problems, whatever. But like, if we could get our acts together, I kind of feel like there's a real opportunity here.
Oh, I think there's a huge opportunity. And that's why what Harry Stebbings is doing in Project Europe is actually quite interesting. I want to see how it plays out. I think it's interesting, but I think that there is a lot of low hanging fruit.
So, for what it's worth, I think it's completely the right direction and it's completely the right thing to have. Well, it is a valid thing to have done, right? Like whether it's right or not, who knows, right? But that's the point.
We'll find out.
Yeah, we'll find out. Like you have people arguing that, well, hold on, you know, why are you restricting to 20-year-olds? Why are you restricting, or whatever the age bracket is? You know, why are you taking 6% equity? Then it's just VC being VC. Like, why aren't you doing it in a different way? Because, you know, Peter Thiel and the fellowship is like a very different structure. And, you know, I have a, you know, Doug Scott, who you probably know of, if not know, you know, he has arguments for that. He's like, he's basically, he's moved to Guernsey. He's like, right, I'll give you $100,000 if you want to come and just have some chats in coffee shops. Yeah. Like that's his, that's, and his approach is that, like, give money to smart people and let them figure it out. Don't worry about the equity side of things. You know, that'll happen at some point, right? I don't know, right? But I think the fact that we're now having this conversation, how do we encourage more people to kind of take those punts and take those punts early, and goes back to your Grad Lancer story. Like when you're doing it at 20, 21, 22, 23, yeah, you'll do the 80 nowadays. Like I can't do that. Why?
But this is the thing, at that age, like I had no ties, like there's nothing. Like, and I was like, well, I can just
no mortgage, no kids.
And that
no
was
whatever.
The reason I was like, oh, I could just focus on this business. I'm in a uni town, which is pretty cheap to live in.
Yeah.
I can continue to do it and see what happens. And that's, yeah, I'd probably, but then outside of that, if you look at half the founders that we brought into Block Dojo, they're older, you know, older founders who've made their money. They've got deep sector expertise. And now they go, actually, now I think I can change it. Like Adeus, one of our companies, they're focusing on probate, the probate market and digitalizing wills and that type of thing. And I was like, yeah, brilliant. Love that.
Yeah.
Then we've got Libraro and Arsim, who's building a publishing platform. And it's like, actually, maybe there's a first stage and then there's a second stage, a second group. Maybe the middle bit's confusing and maybe, you know, they're the ones that you don't go after, but actually maybe you do open it up to some later stage founders. Oh, sorry. Later age founders.
Well, no, the stats also show quite clearly that your mid-40s or your 40s are actually the most successful outcomes for founders.
You told me that before. Yeah,
I know. I mean, it's because I'm in my mid-40s. Like, clearly I'm biased towards a mid. No, look, and again, I think the point is it almost doesn't matter like how they've started. The great thing is that they have started, certainly when talking about Project Europe. But, and this is where my real concern is, like, I think the government, certainly here in the UK, like, it is making it harder and harder to think about, like,
entrepreneurship. Yeah, of course it is. Like, well, and this is where you get back to the Gary Stevenson, Daniel Priestley, Stephen Bartlett podcast. It is that.
Which I never watched.
I watched it. And to be fair, I actually really enjoyed elements of it, shall we say.
God.
I know, just watch it. But I think that's where it is very, very difficult to even consider being an entrepreneur right now because you're thinking about how to survive. But then on the flip side, you know, I went to uni just after the financial crash and I'm like, but that's kind of how I was in that, a similar sort of boat.
It was bad.
When I was going, it's so bad, like, what, do I go get a job or do I try and make something for myself? And, you know, that was...
Yeah, no, look, I think more people could be entrepreneurs if they were able to take the risk, right? I don't think everyone should be an entrepreneur.
No.
Right? And equally, you don't want everyone to be an entrepreneur because you still need people to do work.
No,
right?
But I do think that they should teach more of it from an early age.
I mean, absolutely.
Like that to me is mind blowing. Like the education system doesn't do simple like accounting and things like that.
Forget, but it doesn't even do the one thing that would create like massive wealth in this country is if you taught teenagers not to take out credit card debt and why that's a bad thing, for example.
But there's a reason why they don't tell you that. Like there's a reason why they want, and I say they, I mean, there's a reason why that's not taught is because that's how the money flows. That's what.
Yeah. As an educator, like not that either of us are educators, right? No. But in a school system, like you'd expect like, okay, just basic freaking household budgeting, whatever it is. Yeah,
what taxes mean.
Yeah.
Like what the different taxes are.
I mean, we've had Chris Donegan on the podcast, right? Chris is invested in a business called Black Bullion. Black Bullion was founded by a lady called Vivi Freegut, who I randomly met when I first came back to the UK in 2015. And she's built like essentially a business that does precisely this, but for university students who find themselves in financial difficulties, they are sent to Black Bullion to essentially get not financial advice, but
upskilling,
education, right? Yeah. And hold on, is it like you can't afford your fees for this term, but you were able to get the latest iPhone or whatever. And I know that's a shitty kind of example, but it's that sort of thing. Like, okay, well, hold on a second.
It's true, but then look, when you go to university, you're given like this pot of cash as well in your student loan. And you've got to figure out how to make that work. But no one at any point has told you or taught you how you make this work.
Yeah.
So then you're thrown into that and it can go one way or another pretty quickly.
Well, so Simon Hunt, who is the... Well, he's just taken on a role at City AM, but he used to be on the business side at Evening Standard. He's on Twitter at the moment. Recently, he's been talking because everyone's talking about tax rates and so on. And he's come back and go, well, hold on a second. You're not even talking about the student loan, the impact of that. It's essentially at the age of 20, I got or whatever, 25, I had 50%.
Oh, it's mad. Like my
marginal tax rate.
Mine was what, 1.1% interest. I think my brother's is 6% on his.
And
he's got, what, 45 grand. Like every month he's basically just paying off the interest. And it's like, where does this go from here?
Well, it's not a happy place.
But mine also was only like 15 grand.
And mine wouldn't have even been that, right?
Yeah,
because
I've
got a feeling we were one of the first years. So I graduated in 2001. I think we were one of the first years to pay fees.
Yeah.
And they were at like $3,000 at that time, right? Like it was a different world.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, look, I mean, I think the UK needs to shake itself up a little bit, right? And I think those of us that are in the ecosystem, I mean, obviously you and I, you know, we know we do a lot of stuff wherever we can to kind of promote the ecosystem, and the opportunity the ecosystem provides. But I think there's a lot of work to be done. Listen, this has been an absolutely incredibly wide-ranging podcast. So I want to finish off with a couple of questions, one of which I only recently asked, and it came about because I was like, okay, like I asked ChatGPT where my blind spots were.
Nice.
And it said, maybe you could be a bit more human from time to time. I was like, that's a bit weird. I'm always human. So one of these questions is a new one, ChatGPT recommended. But yes. The first one is, what is one thing that you have a contrarian opinion about from any area of life, whether that's work, politically, socially, or at home?
God, contrarian. I don't know if it's contrarian, but I'd say like consistent. I'm learning more and more that consistency is the key to everything. I think that is... as I'm growing up, as I'm getting older, I've realized that actually if you just stay consistent in routines, in learning and, you know, allocating time to different things per day and actually staying on top of it, actually you can pretty much change your life in a very quick amount of time. You know, if that's reading a book for half an hour a day, if that's going through like a healthcare regime for 30 minutes a day, if that's then going to the gym for an hour a day, if you focus in on these things and forget the noise, it is pretty incredible how quickly you can change your mood, change your attitude, and you know, I don't want to say like the universe gives you back, but it's one of those things that actually you start to realize, you know, you can get out of difficult situations pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I found that to be pivotal, like probably about 7 years ago, and absolutely has changed kind of my life in a multitude of ways, which I'd never expected. And I like, part of the problem for me is I think I have like undiagnosed or underdiagnosed ADHD. And what the realization came that routine actually helps the ADHD, but also the routine has been massively positive in mental health, in physical health, and in just general kind of love of life. So I buy into that. I agree. I'm not sure if that's contrarian, but but like frankly, one of the reasons I asked this question is because I'm yet to hear an actual contrarian opinion. So
no, that's
I don't think they exist outside of Twitter. And I mean
contrarian, I believe that Web3 is a great thing. Maybe that's contrarian. I think it's going to be
possibly.
Yeah
I mean, I think a lot of people are performatively contrarian.
Yeah, agreed.
Which may in itself be a contrarian opinion. Okay, so we'll get to the last question, right? So want to know the real you. Tell me something that moves you the most emotionally.
God, this is such a difficult one because I'm literally not an emotional being at all, and my wife can vouch for that. But I think what makes me emotional? I think it's wanting to be seen now a little bit more. I know it sounds ridiculous, but it's like, what am I doing all of this for? I want, you know, almost like it. I don't know if that's the right way to put it, but like feel like I'm doing something that's of value to a lot of people or to a big ecosystem or to, you know, to me, my wife, whatever. It's like that makes me quite emotional, being able to do something that I feel is like actually moving the needle in something.
I think that's lovely. I think, you know, we talked about whether because you're brown, you had like entrepreneurial drive. I think a lot of this comes back to religious background as well.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, one of the lovely things about Gurudwara is obviously, you know, feeding people on a regular basis, right? Yeah. Like, we, you know, similarly in my kind of culture, you know, similar sort of aspects. I honestly do think that sentiment, if I can put it that way, is a very Eastern philosophical kind of sentiment. And as you grow, as you build your family, you start wanting to give back more to community.
It's like what my wife asked me, like, if I ever won the lottery, what would I do? And it's like the first thing, and hers is exactly the same, is like, oh, I'd pay off your family's mortgages, like
100%.
Pay off my family's mortgages, like I'd buy houses for whoever and give, you know, my mates this and all that sort of stuff. And I don't know how many other people would have that sort of view, but that's almost how I feel like, you know, what makes me emotional is I want to succeed to be able to do that.
Yeah.
But not just for like my family, for other people as well, because I find it quite, it's like when I'm one of those people at Christmas and birthday, I prefer to give because I like to see reactions rather than to receive it.
Yeah, I absolutely hate it. I don't know.
It
feels like we're brothers from another mother. Listen, Jay, it's been absolutely fantastic having you on the podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to sit here and noodle through all of this. For the audience, where can they find you online? You're on LinkedIn, Twitter. Where's the best place for them to look for you?
Good point. Yeah, Twitter X, formerly known as Twitter.
Yeah, yeah, that.
At Jay Goodrell. I think every platform I'm at Jay Goodrell. So JayGuJrell.
Well, we'll be dropping the links in the show notes in any case. But for the time being, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.